For Sounds of Dissent, I'm John Grebe. In the New York Times, Andrew Ross Sorkin writes about Tim Pawlenty, former Republican governor of Minnesota. Over a year ago, while running for president on the Republican ticket, railing against big banks, Tim Pawlenty said, "I went to Wall Street and told them to get their snout out of the trough because they are some of the worst offenders when it comes to bailouts and carve-outs and special deals." Last week, Pawlenty was named president of the Financial Services Roundtable, one of Wall Street's most influential lobbying organizations. As Sorkin continues, he writes, in his new job, in which his predecessor was paid $1.8 million annually, Pawlenty will spend his days shuttling around Washington, trying to convince lawmakers that those carve-outs and special deals really are beneficial for the nation's banking system, though presumably without putting his snout in the trough. I'm very glad we have with us today to take a look at some of this, Mike Konzel, a writer and fellow at the Roosevelt Institute in New York. He's worked as a quantitative analyst, a financial engineer for several years, and writes for the Roosevelt Institute's Next New Deal blog. Mike Konzel, thank you so much for joining us today and welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Mike, you wrote an interesting piece about what you thought this effect could be, bank lobbying, on the Dodd-Frank bill. That is, in general, financial regulation of major investment banks, the kind of regulation that has been in place for many decades in the United States that might have prevented, if it were enforced or stronger, might have prevented the entire economic collapse of 2007-2008.
Yeah, so the Pawlenty pick is very interesting. It implies that Wall Street is going to have a much more long-term relationship with the Republican Party. Presumably, there's a lot of different ex-politicians they could have chosen for that spot, but choosing someone who is a very visible primary runner in the Republican Party is implies both that implies that at least Republicans will hold the House, but at least they think they will, and crucially, that they really want to build this out. So what does it mean policy-wise? Well, you know, we're looking now at various things the Financial Services Roundtable is really pushing and things that we're seeing the Republicans also push in the Congress. And what they really want to do is dismantle the funding and structure of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which has been doing great work since it was instituted 2 years ago. They want to remove regulations on derivatives, and they also want to destroy something called the Volcker Rule, which is kind of like a sort of like Glass-Steagall in the sense that it spins out hedge fund-like casino gambling from some of the more risky and vulnerable large banks that really form the core of the financial sector.
How can you tell? How do you know the big banks want to work on repealing the Volcker Rule and getting rid of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which incidentally, Elizabeth Warren was the President Obama's first appointee to be considered. She didn't quite make it there because Republicans in power in Congress made it so ultra clear they would utterly reject Elizabeth Warren's clearly stated desire to reform banks and protect consumers.
Well, to go even further, the Republicans in the Senate in particular made it very clear. They wrote several letters to the president that are public, saying that beyond rejecting Elizabeth Warren, they'd reject any candidate, including Republican or very moderate candidates, to run the CFPB. President Obama had Teresa appoint Rob Corddry so the CFPB could take off. And the reason they did it is because they didn't like the funding structure and they didn't like the institutional structure of the CFPB. Now, it's a long story, but the way the CFPB is funded, which is through the Federal Reserve, and the way it's institutionally built makes it look like other strong regulators, including regulators from the New Deal era, things like the CFTC or the FDIC. It's meant to prevent Congress from being able to just unilaterally, cause it to cut its funding if they don't like what it's doing. It's made to prevent corruption and capture by the financial industry because it's independently funded. So it looks to be a very strong regulator, and we're seeing very good results. Republicans want an agency that they can always kind of, throw in the back room or really cut the knees out from under if they need to. So that we know that that's happening because it's obviously happening, right? The Republicans are putting it forward publicly that they want to accomplish those things. The Financial Services Roundtable, which Tim Pawlenty will take over, we're seeing that it just won a major case against derivatives reform that it was pushing against on Friday. Circuit Court threw out the ability to limit speculation in commodities. So we're seeing movement on a lot of fronts. We see it through statements that are made, things that are said off record or on background, and we're also seeing it in the policy papers put forward.
One of the conditions that apparently Tim Pawlenty had of taking that position, he agreed to resign as co-chairman of the Mitt Romney for President campaign and agreed not to serve in a Romney administration if Romney were elected. He had also been, I guess, on the short list of vice presidential candidates to serve with Mitt Romney. What do you think about that move? Does it signal something about Romney's lack of or the lack of certainty about Romney's electability that he would make this shift to a much more certain post where he'd be able to serve regardless of who's elected?
Tim Pawlenty did not have a very good run at the presidency, and obviously he wasn't picked for vice president. But from what people can tell, he was very, in consideration for a secretary-level job or a cabinet-level job or a very high-level job in the Romney administration. So, you don't want to overread these things, but it's clearly not a sign of strength in the Romney campaign. And since, for a variety of reasons, mostly starting when Paul Ryan came on the ticket, but also things like Todd Akin from Missouri, the released tapes of the 47% comments, Mitt Romney's had a really bad month. So if people wanted to leave but also believed that the Republicans would have some levers in Congress, especially, say, controlling the House, that's a very win-win for the financial services industry and Tim Pawlenty.
Mike Kunzel, you worked as a quantitative analyst and a financial engineer for several years, and you're now a research fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. But in your work in the financial sector, as a financial engineer, a mathematician, did you hear about an organization like this roundtable, and these other bank lobbying groups, the financial services roundtable? Was that kind of news that ever filtered down to the people who did the detailed economic mathematics, or did you hear about that in the financial companies that you worked in?
Well, for better or for worse, I wasn't actually in a position that would face Congress. I was very much in the back room working on the algorithms and whatnot. And I also crucially left the industry by 2009. So, when I was there, there was a presumption, I think, at least a national presumption, that Wall Street should just kind of do what it does, and that to the extent that there will be problems, they can be handled on an individual basis. It can be handled through, say, criminal law, and that, if there are failures, we can just, let the firms fail through bankruptcy or through normal mechanisms, and there'll be one-on-one cases. We will never see a systemic crisis like we saw in the Great Depression. The Federal Reserve can basically handle any business cycle crash, and, when there are bad apples, we'll go after them. And, that was the kind of ideology that was going, certainly since Bill Clinton and Republicans under Gingrich repealed Glass-Steagall and really deregulated the derivatives market in the late 90s. Obviously all that's gone now. It's not clear what kind of ideology will take it over, but right now there is, a concern that it's very difficult to allow a bank to firm without imposing huge costs on third parties that weren't involved. There's real worry that, there's systemically risky firms out there, and there's, obviously a real worry that we aren't enforcing our criminal justice laws when it comes to fraud and all kinds of other issues.
Tell us again, Mike Kunzel, the Volcker Rule, it's a particular section of the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform Act. It was former U.S. Federal Reserve Chairman Paul Volcker who apparently proposed it. Why does that rule play such an important part in discussions about potential financial reform? And how did it used to apply in the United States?
So the Volcker Rule, Dodd-Frank was introduced and it passed the House in December 2009. And then the final bill would pass, in June, and then was signed into law in July of 2010. After it passed the House, I think there was some major disappointments that the bill was not strong enough. And ironically, given how bills usually pass in the United States, the Senate bill was much stronger. I think after the House bill, which involved a lot of new Democrats and blue dogs and very conservative Democrats who very much did not, you know, were extensions of the financial industry in some cases, worked very hard to water it down, where I think people understood that this was a very important bill and that those things couldn't happen and or those things should not happen. And so the Senate bill was tightened up quite a bit. But one of the other major differences was that in January 2010, or maybe February, Paul Volcker and President Obama released something called the Volcker Rule, which was designed to take hedge funds, which or take proprietary trading, which is trading with your own money for your own gain, and remove them from things that are called systemically important financial firms, or the types of firms that need additional regulation and additional law to take down in case of a crisis. Now, why do you do that? Because hedge funds, we saw with J.P. Morgan earlier this year, we saw with Bear Stearns during the crisis. Hedge funds, you know, the model is often called picking up nickels in front of a steamroller. When it works, you make a little bit of money, but when it's a disaster, it's a big disaster. And what happens with a lot of these banks is that if they have a huge loss, like, you know, $7 billion within a quarter out of nowhere, that it causes panics in such a way. It's also believed that that kind of trading, that kind of market making, that kind of market activity will be covered by hedge funds and other firms out there. So the idea is to take risk and move it out of that part of the financial system, especially because it's not clear what value it adds to these to the system as a whole. That's a big change. It's a huge change given how, you know, the idea over the past 30 years was to make banks as big and as complicated and as have many business lines as possible. As such, since it's such a big change, there's a lot of pushback from the financial service lobbyists.
So there was apparently a very large loss, a trading loss at J.P. Morgan Chase, and the Senate is investigating it. And whatever investigation results, whatever results of that investigation are, may have some impact on the way that the Volcker Rule finally gets implemented. What do you think about that?
I think it's very important to understand why it's a big deal. You know, under capitalism, we really want firms to be able to fail in an appropriate manner. And what we're finding is that, you know, when we let Lehman Brothers fail, it put all kinds of losses on other parties, which is to say it caused a huge financial panic, which almost meant, you know, regular people might not have been able to, you know, go about their daily, you know, financial interactions. So we tried to put new rules in to take down a firm. So when FDIC takes over a community bank over a week and then reopens it, they now have the legal ability to do that, things that are more traditionally financial firms. Now, a big impediment to that working well is that they can't have situations where there's big losses out of nowhere. They essentially have to come in. There's a lot of mechanisms, like picture like a car with brakes that kind of stagger so that, you know, if you hit a rough patch of road, the car will automatically adjust to try to calm down. That's kind of like how Dodd-Frank works with trying to take down a major bank. The big problem is if you have a giant loss out of nowhere. And J.P. Morgan, which is one of the, you know, it has a fortress balance sheet, it likes to describe, it had a $7 billion, it might even be higher by the time they unwind it, loss out of nowhere. That's very difficult for a lot of these banks, which are, you know, often on much thinner margins. They're often, you know, they have a capital base, but it's not designed to take those kinds of losses that were essentially to just try to pick up a few nickels here and there. They were just there to try to, you know, skim a little bit of money out of a credit default market. So my biggest hope, you know, obviously if there are criminal issues involved, that's very important to figure out. But my bigger hope is that it really points out the need to say, this kind of activity adds very little value to a firm like J.P. Morgan. It's just a way for a couple people to make outsized risks. And to the extent that if it crashed overnight without the FDIC really being able to take it over, it could impose huge losses on the economy. That's a big problem, and we need laws and regulation to tackle it.
Now, J.P. Morgan that we're talking about, along with Bank of America, Wells Fargo, U.S. Bancorp, Citigroup, they together hold 52% of all U.S. deposits, according to a report that came out early in 2012, Choosing the Road to Prosperity, Why We Must End Too Big to Fail Now. It made quite a splash because it didn't come from any kind of random analyst outside the banking industry or any columnist or the New York Times. It came from the Federal Reserve Board of Dallas, Texas. Federal Reserve Board, there are a number of them all around the United States. There's one in Boston. They all together sort of make up certain parts. They're mostly bankers who serve on those boards and represent big banks in each region. And then there's a sort of a federal constellation of them as well. The Federal Reserve Board of Dallas, its chief wrote in this report that the nation's largest banks are a perversion of capitalism. Those are his words, a perversion of capitalism, and, quote, a clear and present danger to the U.S. economy, end quote. And then it says that the Dodd-Frank bill, which was supposed to regulate the financial industry, quote, may actually perpetrate an already dangerous trend of increasing banking industry concentration, end quote. This is the words of Dallas Fed CEO and president Richard W. Fisher. We talked about this in the program in early 2012. It's been widely reported. Mike Kunzel, I wonder what your reaction is to that kind of discussion happening. And apparently he's not the only Fed leader who's started to talk about that.
Yeah, no, Tom Honig, who's from Kansas City, he's also on the Federal Reserve Board of Kansas City, makes incredibly similar remarks. And I believe he now works for the FDIC, or he's been proposed to work for the FDIC. I'm not sure he's been if he's gone through the confirmation process yet. But so there's two different arguments there. One is, to what extent is concentration and the large size of the largest banks a major issue for the financial sector? And the other issue is whether or not Dodd-Frank perpetrates or exacerbates those problems. I think the second issue is overblown, or at least I haven't seen the case properly made. What you notice, so what part of what Dodd-Frank does is it says, if you're a financial firm over $50 billion in size, you need additional rules to be regulated. You need to understand that the FDIC could take over your business to wind it down in a bankruptcy-like action. And you also have to understand that you need to hold more capital for your derivatives, for your loans. You're essentially you need a little extra padding on the kind of bumpers for your bank, right? Now, what his critique of Dodd-Frank is says, by saying that, you're going to encourage banks to take risk because they think they're protected by the government if they get this designation. We crucially don't see that. Banks that are on the margin are trying to fight getting that title instead of actively lobbying to try to get it. So I think the subtle critique, but it's an important one to watch for, of Dodd-Frank is not in play. I do very much worry about concentration in the financial sector, and I do worry about the increase in it since 2007. The five largest banks have gotten bigger. And I think they're very politically powerful, and I think that makes it very difficult to deal with things like foreclosure crisis and debt overhangs that are really ravaging our neighborhoods and really destroying communities. I think if the five largest banks were less politically powerful, you'd see not only just less lobbying and more effective financial reform, but also a real difference in people's lives when it comes to things like foreclosure. Tim Pawlenty, when he was building his reputation in the 2000s, brandished himself as a Sam's Club Republican. And, this was the title that was thrown to him, Sam's Club Conservative, Sam's Club Republican, which is to say he thought conservatives and Republicans should worry a lot more about working class people instead of the top 1% and then CEOs, do things like, bolster child tax credits and things that would really build out the working class. And, the financial service industry right now is not working in that venue. It's working towards things like foreclosures and stripping communities of their value, things that should be really offensive to people who are worried about our communities.
Mike, I'm also curious to ask you a bit about, you've written recently in Salon magazine, online magazine, about the 47%, and you gave several histories of the right wing's 47% theory. Of course, we're talking about the number that Mitt Romney threw out in a speech that was exposed recently, although he made it early in 2012, saying that 47% of the American electorate are dependents, and made some other remarks that people don't quite take cotton to so well.
Right, right. So, I've been watching a lot of conservative rhetoric, especially in the past 4 years. And, when Mitt Romney said, 47% of Americans don't pay taxes, and that 47% of people are essentially beyond help. They can't take care of themselves. They can't show responsibility. And the Republican Party should not worry about them except to make sure that, you know, we can they can mobilize the other 53%. That actually has a long history during the Obama years. That wasn't like a random thing Mitt Romney said to a wealthy donor who's trying to humor. It's actually a very core ideological conceit within the Republican mind. And the important thing about it is not that it's just a little bit unfair or that, you know, certain types of cohorts in the United States should pay a little bit more tax. Now, to remind your viewer or your listeners, that meme is kind of made up, is entirely made up. Of the 47% is really people who don't pay payroll taxes. And that's primarily either students, young people, the elderly or retirees, or people who are extra dependent on, or people who take advantage of tax credits, which, you know, when people do that, especially the EITC, they usually only do it for a year or two, perhaps because they just became unemployed, perhaps their labor market situation has changed up a bit. So it's not a permanent group. And that group of, and the people in the 47% pay all kinds of other taxes. But crucially, when you think of how the right talks about it, they think of that 47% as a political group. It's a consistent class of people who express a kind of class solidarity and have class interests. And the consequences aren't just that, you know, the rich pay a little bit more, the poor pay a little bit less, but that it has a real detrimental consequences for the United States as a whole. And so when you see kind of theories of the 47%, you have theories that come out of the think tanks that are very popular with, American Enterprise Institute, for instance, that says, you know, it's a small group of liberal intellectuals that are trying to create this 47% to undermine the government, to introduce socialism. You have some people who say, you know, maybe the 47% themselves are trying to just vote away everyone else's earnings in this kind of very public choice critique of, you know, saying democracy is ultimately about the poor ripping off the rich. And you see that certain Republican senators say that kind of thing. You have other people like Paul Ryan who says that it's all about the safety net. And our safety net is so generous, which it is not, that it, you know, it makes people just not want to take care of themselves or not really want to engage with their lives. You can find what I wrote, online. They have a long history, and I think it's very influential to understanding how Republicans interact with the social safety net these days.
Mike Konzel, thank you so much for joining us today on Sounds of Dissent.
No, thank you so much for having me.
Mike Konzel is a researcher and a research fellow at the Roosevelt Institute in New York, who worked as a quantitative analyst, a financial engineer for several years. He writes and blogs at the Next New Deal blog of the Roosevelt Institute, and also at publications like the Salon.com magazine. For Sounds of Dissent, I'm John Grebe.